Welcome to Sharkpedia. We're your hosts, Megan
and Imani,
a couple of shark researchers that want to bring the science to you.
We're creating a space to learn all things sharks
and their relatives,
answer your questions,
and learn from the legends in the field.
Get ready to jump in.
Let's dive deep into the world of sharks. Welcome back, Sharkies, to Sharkpedia. We're so excited to have another episode today. We have guest expert Vicky Fong. Vicky is a manta ray expert, and we are going to go over her article, Using Drones to Assess Volitional Swimming Kinematics of Manta Ray Behaviors in the Wild. And that paper is by Fong, Hoffman, and Pate. So Vicky, thank you so much for being here. We're really excited to talk to you more about this paper and learn more about flat sharks. This is only the second time we've had someone on the podcast talk about flat sharks. So could you take a moment to introduce yourself to our Sharkies and tell us a little bit about your background?
Yeah, thank you for having me today. My name is Vicky Fong, and I work as a research assistant with the Florida Manta Project, which is part of the larger nonprofit organization, the Marine Megafauna Foundation. My background, I studied at the University of California, Berkeley in my undergrad, and I studied environmental biology and conservation. And broadly, my research interests are in elasmobranch biology, ecology, and conservation.
How did you get into manta rays? Because I feel like we have a lot of younger listeners, and a lot of people constantly ask, like, how do you go from undergrad to the thing that you want to do? So I'm wondering how you went from undergrad to this really cool job.
Well, I've been in love with the ocean from a very young age, and I think and I've been snorkeling, and I grew up in Hong Kong, actually, so I was really lucky to be around water all the time and exposed to great marine life. And I think the spark really hit, clicked when I learned how to scuba dive at the age of 15. And from then I really tried to get my hands wet with trying different things in the field. And when I think I was a sophomore in college, I spent some time volunteering with the Indo-Ocean Project. They're a nonprofit in Indonesia. And during dives with them, I learned about manta rays and saw my first manta ray, and I absolutely fell in love. They're just the most graceful, magical creatures in the water. And I've always loved sharks, and I think that rays don't get enough representation in the shark and ray world. And I think really what made me fall more in love with mantas was learning about their directed fishery in Asia and how they're used in traditional Chinese medicine. And me growing up as someone who's Chinese and from a Chinese household, I went back to my parents and asked them about this, and they had no idea that what was part of a manta ray's body was actually like in jars in like a traditional Chinese medicine shop in Hong Kong. And I think that was really what inspired me to learn more about these animals. I found out that not that much research has been done about them. Only in the last like decade or so has most manta research has really been done. So it's a really emerging field. And yeah, I actually have a really funny story of how I got this job, but I basically reached out to my supervisor, Jessica Pate, who you had on the show on a previous episode on Instagram. So moral of the story, reach out to people you want to work with, talk to them. I mean, I didn't go in like asking for a job. I was just like, hey, I think your work is super cool. Can we chat about it further? And one thing led to another. And I've been working with Jess for the past year, and I've absolutely been loving it.
Amazing.
I love that story.
Awesome.
That's amazing.
Yeah. We tried getting Jessica to recruit us so that we could see mantas when we had her on in season one. So maybe I'll slide into her Instagram messages, and maybe then I'll get in.
Yeah. That's honestly how we get a lot of the volunteers for our work, is just passionate people who want to get in the field and reach out. But if you guys are ever in Florida, I'm sure we can squeeze you in on the manta boat and get you guys to see some mantas, hopefully.
Oh my gosh. I'm so in. That sounds amazing.
Say less. Yeah. I'm getting my flight right now.
Oh my god, I love it. Okay, well, let's get into the paper. I want to make sure our Sharkies have an opportunity to hear this awesome flat shark research. This paper was written by Fong, Hoffman, and Pate in 2022. It was just recently published. And the title of their article is Using Drones to Assess Volitional Swimming Kinematics of Manta Ray Behaviors in the Wild. So today, the summary that we're going to use is actually their abstract, because their abstract was really easy to follow. So we wanted to just go ahead and use that. And their abstract says, drones have become increasingly popular tools to study marine megafauna, but are underutilized in batoid research. They use drones to collect video data of manta ray Mobula birostris swimming and assessed behavior-specific kinematics in Caniva, a semi-automated point tracking software. They describe a resting behavior of mantas making use of a strong current and man-made inlets in addition to known traveling and feeding behaviors. No significant differences were found between swimming speed of traveling and feeding behaviors, although feeding mantas had significantly higher wing beat frequency than traveling mantas. Resting mantas swim at a significantly slower speed and wing beat frequency, suggesting that they were continuously swimming with the minimum effort required to maintain position and buoyancy. Swimming speed and wing beat frequency of traveling and feeding behaviors overlapped, which could point to other factors such as prey availability and transitional behavior influencing how manta rays swim. These baseline swimming kinematic data have valuable applications to other emerging technologies in manta ray research. Okay, so one of our first questions is about drones. Drones have become a great alternative to small planes and helicopters. But I wondered if you know when roughly drones actually started to become part of the scientific method for some of this research. It seems like it's been rather recent.
Mm-hmm. So drones have become increasingly popular in scientific research, and specifically elasmobranch research, in the last decade or so. And drone technology has improved really at a rapid speed, so now it's readily available for all consumers and scientists. And there are some great review papers out there that has looked at how drones have been used in shark research and has highlighted that there has actually been a lack of research in batoids. So we're trying to contribute to that.
That's amazing. And actually, do you mind telling our Sharkies what batoids are in case they're not sure?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So batoids are rays.
Woohoo. AKA flat sharks.
Are pancakes only skates, or does pancake also apply to rays?
Oh, I totally think pancakes applies to rays. I think I've definitely seen a meme floating around on the internet where it's a pancake and a manta ray shaped in a pancake.
Oh, definitely. People also call them sea raviolis, but I think I only saw that in a meme about skates because they're like,
I don't think I've heard sea raviolis. That's awesome.
There was a picture of like a bunch of skates, I think, against a window, probably in like an aquarium or something, and you could see their insides, and someone just wrote sea raviolis.
That's amazing.
Oh my gosh, I love that. Well, I think it's so cool that you're able to use drones for your research. And you mentioned that drones are pretty restricted to animals that occupy both shallow habitats and clear water. And man, that's so true, because I'm really jealous, actually. I live in San Francisco. My research is in San Francisco, and that water is basically mud. So I can't use drones as much as I would love to, because there's so many elasmobranchs in the bay.
Yeah, that's the San Francisco Bay water is definitely not the ideal candidate for drone use. But yes, using drones does limit us to studying animals in clear waters and shallow habitats. But with manta rays, we're really lucky that we see them either feeding or basking in the sun at the surface.
I don't think I knew that manta rays basked in the sun.
Yeah, they like to come up to the surface from depth so that they can warm up.
Like a lizard on a rock. That's amazing.
Do they do that for parasite reasons too? Like, I know the ocean sunfish will sometimes sit at the surface so that the sun can help scorch off parasites on their skin.
That's interesting. I'm not sure about the parasites. For most manta rays around the world, you'll see them at cleaning stations where there are cleaner fish like wrasse that will pick the parasites off them. But here in South Florida, we haven't found their cleaning station just yet. So, and we don't see that many parasites on manta rays. So that could be an interesting reason. We're not exactly sure how they get parasites off them just yet.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing.
To be continued.
Yes, many questions to be answered.
So manta rays use their pectoral fins for high propulsive swimming efficiency. Do you know if wing flapping is more energy efficient than tail beating? I guess, you know, like sharks, they swim with their tails, and then you have rays that use their wings. Do you know if one is more energy efficient than the other?
So I think it has to do with how their morphology has changed. So for most rays, and besides our more sharkier looking rays that are like the sawfish or the guitarfish, they have evolved really flat pectoral fins that are fused to their bodies and really skinnier tails that are not used for swimming. And a good analogy of how manta rays swim is how a bird flies in the sky. So they flap their large wings, or in this case, pectoral fins, and glide through the air, or in case the ocean. So these rays have evolved to have really flat bodies, and they are able to flap with really high propulsive efficiency and utilize gliding through the water too. So they are really efficient swimmers.
Awesome. And then, so the main purpose of your research was to look at the kinematics of how they're swimming. And I wondered, I actually hadn't really ever heard of kinematic analysis. And I wondered if you could describe for me and for our listeners what kinematic analysis is.
Yeah. So the field of kinematics is basically looking at the different features of movement in an object. So this could look at humans or other animals, or in this case, we are looking at manta rays. And in this study, we were specifically interested in how fast they swim and how often they beat their pectoral fins. And these were things that we were able to look at in two dimension with the drones, but there are many more kinematic variables that one can look at, especially if you have three-dimensional footage.
So in this article, you mentioned that previously researchers had relied on estimations of swimming speed in the field to calculate prey density threshold of mantas, but empirical measurements of swimming speed would improve inference to future studies on feeding ecology, migration, and energetics. Could you just expand on this? What is prey density threshold, and how would empirical measurements improve future studies?
Yeah, so this refers to a feeding ecology study done previously where they collected samples of plankton, so that's what mantas feed on, to find out whether a certain density or size of plankton triggered feeding in manta rays. So prey density threshold is an estimation that takes into account the animal's energy requirements and the density of the prey that triggers feeding. So feeding is an energetically expensive behavior. It's really costly for the animal. So the animal has to have a net gain in calories to incentivize them to do this behavior. And this calculation is a metabolic calculation that requires a lot of data, including how fast an animal swims when they are feeding. And so in this study, they estimated it based on personal observations of the manta ray swimming. So if we were able to collect kinematic data with drones, it gives us more accurate empirical measurements that we can incorporate into these feeding ecology and energetic calculations. And we actually used our own swimming speed data recently to ground truth data from our satellite tags to help us learn more about the migration of manta rays and, yeah, long distance swimming.
Oh my gosh, that's so cool. The technologies are just making shark research even more insane every year, I swear.
Definitely. We're all learning a lot about technology and these animals we study.
Yeah. So your paper had kind of four general hypotheses that I want to just state for our sharkies. First, you predicted that there is a positive relationship between swimming speed and wing beat frequency. Your second hypothesis was that feeding mantas swim slower than traveling mantas to optimize filter feeding in dense plankton patches. Third, traveling mantas swim faster for more efficient transits. And then lastly, resting mantas have a slower wing beat frequency to conserve energy. So in general, especially for earlier scientists that listen to this podcast, I wanted to know, you know, how did you come up with these hypotheses? Is it just based on observations or like how did you get there? Because that's sometimes the hardest thing about research is figuring out the question you want to answer.
Yeah, definitely. So we looked at previous research that was done to come up with these hypotheses. So there were previous studies done in aquariums that looked at kinematic analyses, as well as kinematic data of manta ray behaviors collected from satellite data. These were all different methods that looked at manta ray kinematics, but it helped us form the hypotheses of how manta ray swimming kinematics would relate to behavior.
When using a drone, do you have to have a special permit for it at all?
You don't need a special permit to drone manta rays, and drones are commercially available, so people can buy drones and fly them. And we see a lot of people flying drones in South Florida because we have such great conditions to observe many animals like sharks and mantas and other rays and dolphins.
Right. Have you ever noticed the mantas reacting to the drones in any way? Is there any way to like measure if they are basically aware of them being around?
That is an interesting question. I don't think I've noticed a manta react to the drone. It is quite a small object flying above them and they are in the water. I think there have been previous studies done showing that drones might have an impact on animals that are like above the surface or flying like other flying animals like birds, but we have not seen that.
So you used a free software called Kinovia to analyze the video footage. What is this program? What does it do exactly?
Yeah, so Kinovia was great. Kinovia was actually developed as a sports analysis tool to analyze humans in sports, but it worked great for our work. And traditionally, this type of research will be done using a manual software, which require you to click each data point in each frame. So that would be 30 frames per second. And we're looking at clips that are 5 to 20 seconds long. So that's a lot of frames, which is very time intensive. On the other hand, Kinovia has a great point tracking feature that allows us to semi-automate this process, and it saves us a lot of time.
I love when we invent things for people and then scientists are like, ooh, this is useful for fish. Ooh, this is useful for mice. And the people are like, that's not what I made it for, but okay.
Right. Very handy indeed. And it's great that it's a freeware because tools in science can be expensive, and this is available for everyone to use.
We love free stuff.
So by using that software, you measured the wing beat cycle, which is defined as the time between two peaks. Can you explain that a little bit for our listeners?
Yeah, so the points that we are tracking in each clip are three different ones. First, you have the tip of the left pectoral fin, you have the tip of the right pectoral fin, and then the tail is used to measure speed. So for the wingtips, we are tracking the points as the wingtips are moving, flapping up and down and across the frame. We then take these points and we export it as a Excel file, and then we can play with the data and map out these points. And when we map out these points, they usually come out in waves where you can see the wing beat is at the surface, it flaps down, and then it flaps back up again. So we can take the time that correlates with the point where the wing beat is at the surface, and then find the next point where the wing beat is at the surface and calculate the time in between those two, the time in between that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Yeah. And so I was kind of surprised in your article. You said that when you're videoing these mantas, mm-hmm. there was between 2 to 6 wing beats, which I thought actually was rather short. I kind of imagined that these drones were following them for a long time. Do the mantas get out of the frame rather quickly?
Yes. So at the lower altitudes that we're filming at to get the high quality videos, they do move through the frame rather quickly, and we can only analyze them when they are fully in the frame. And the drone also has to be still hovering over the animals so that we can get a good measurement for speed. So we would stop the drone and position it in a good place to for the animal to swim through the frame. And then we'll follow the animal again. And then we'll take multiple clips during the same encounter. And then for the analyses, we'll like choose the best video for each encounter.
Is that pretty challenging? That sounds like a lot of drone practice.
Yes, Jessica is the one who flies the drone mostly, and she has had lots of practice in operating the drones and learning how to work with the animals. But it has taken a lot of trial and error. So when we were first starting this project, we were trying to look at old videos of that were previously collected. And we were trying to, when Jess started this project, she had a lot of videos just backed up of manta ray swimming, and we were trying to figure out what can we do with all of these videos. And we found out that they were either not low enough, the glare was too high, we couldn't see the animal, the videos weren't long enough, the animal wasn't fully in the frame. So it did take a lot of trial and error, and we ended up having to collect a lot of new videos for this study. But yes, it does take a lot of practice to fly the drone.
I was going to say, like, oh, there's no trees to fly into. And then in my head, I was like, but there's a big body of water below you that you can't go in. So is it really that much easier?
Yeah, hardest part, I would say, is probably like landing the drone on the boat, because you have a moving vessel.
I didn't and think if you about miss, that.
You would, it would drop in the ocean. So drone catching is probably a skill that I have picked up that I would have not expected myself to be good at in the last, if you had asked me before I started this job.
Can we give you a pilot license? Like a drone pilot license that certified ability to land a drone on a boat?
There is actually a drone pilot's license that you have to get if you're using drones for commercial purposes. But I do want to get my drone pilot's license one day and really learn the ins and outs of operating a drone. But so far, it's just been catch the drone and try not to chop my fingers off while doing so. And it's great. It really incentivizes you to catch a drone.
Yes, please keep all of your fingers.
Done so far. Hopefully my track record stays clean.
Absolutely. Oh my God, so the kinematic analysis was standardized by body length. Can you just explain, one, why it's important to do that, but also what do you mean when you say standardized by body length?
Yeah, so body length is a standard measurement in the field of kinematics because actual body length measurements are not always available. And this allows us to compare movement of animals across different sizes. So all the animals that we are working with here are juveniles, and they are all in similar sizes, but this allows us to standardize their movement.
So standardizing basically just, if they're all slightly different lengths, when you do the comparisons, it kind of puts them all into the same playing field so that your analysis is accurate. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah, and when we're measuring swimming speed, we are actually taking their body length into account. So we are measuring how many body lengths are they moving per second, because we don't have the actual, like, we don't have a measurement of meters in terms of the drone. We didn't have like a reference of like a meter stick or anything. So this allows us to standardize that element.
And actually, I think I forgot to ask this earlier. Can you explain how you got those standard lengths? Like, how did you measure the length of one of the manta rays in the videos?
Yeah, so I would take a screenshot of the video and then put it in a software called ImageJ, and then I would calculate the number of pixels.
Oh, cool.
The number of pixels that is from the mouth to the base of the tail.
Got it. Okay, cool. Amazing. I've used ImageJ before. Another free software. That's amazing. Free software, free software. Mm-hmm.
Thank you to everyone who produces free software that we can put fish stuff into.
Yeah, seriously.
And for a lot of, and for some of these mantas, we actually have collected more accurate measurements of some manta ray individuals using laser photogrammetry, where there is a GoPro stationed between two laser points that are at a set distance. And we can actually convert some of these body lengths per second measurements to meters per second and have and know how fast they are actually swimming.
Oh, that's so cool. And then I thought this was so cool. In your paper, you talk about, you call this like fine scale movements when you're just looking at these short clips of these videos. Those are fine or small scale movements. But you wanted to calculate whether or not these fine scale movements could be extrapolated to look at large scale movements for like migrations and things. And I wondered if you could expand on this. Mm-hmm. Like, what's the importance of being able to predict large scale movements based on what you're seeing in these frames?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we are only looking at snapshots of manta ray swimming in these finer scales, swimming in our kinematic analyses and when we're looking at fine scale swimming speeds. So we wanted to see if the data lined up with larger scale movements. We can't follow the, we can't have the drone following the manta for hours and do kinematic analyses that way. So we wanted to see if it could be extrapolated to larger scale movements. And how we did this was when we saw individuals multiple times during the same day or consecutive days on boat surveys, and they were known to be traveling in a certain direction, we calculated the distance between the manta encounters and the time between the manta encounters. So we had an estimation of how fast the animal was swimming between those encounters to get the larger scale swimming speeds. And we found that they were not significantly different. So this shows us that studying finer scale swimming speeds can actually teach us about these larger scale movements and migrations.
So cool. And actually, you're kind of touching on another question I had, which is, how did you find those mantas again? There was one, or a manta you said that was almost 40 miles apart or 60,000 meters apart for everyone that's not in the U.S. That seems like a really far distance to just stumble upon the same one the next day. Was that planned or just by chance?
It was by chance. So some of the mantas we see in the same day, some of them... And we can identify manta individuals, I should say first, by their ventral spot pattern. So each manta has a unique spot pattern. So if we are able to get in the water with the manta ray, we can identify the individual of the manta ray. And sometimes we also get sightings from what we call citizen science sightings. So these are other people that see manta rays. They send in photos and videos of manta rays that they see, and they can cover distances that we can't in a single day or in consecutive days. We also travel pretty far within our own survey area. So we go all the way from Boynton Beach Inlet up to St. Lucie and sometimes even further. So we alternate whether we go north and south on boats. It's always a great surprise to see the same manta across different days.
Yeah, no kidding.
Do you have a favorite manta?
Oof, that's a tough question. I have some favorites. Well, everyone's favorite at the Manta Project is Sky, because he is the most friendly manta, and he has actually been immortalized into the first ever 3D manta model. I can send you guys the link to that afterwards, but we've created
a
3D model of a manta ray, and it was based off of video footages of Sky. And we actually were incorporated kinematic data into that as well, because they used the wing beat frequency of Sky specifically to create that model. So
he doesn't know he's a star.
He probably does. He's the most friendly manta. He loves to swim underneath all of us and just like watching you. And we've gotten amazing photos of him. Another one of my favorites is a manta I've named Nemo. He is not the most friendly manta, but we've named him Nemo because he's missing his right cephalic fin. And so that's sad, but we've seen him so many times this year. I can keep naming mantas off the top of my head, but there are so many.
Don't ask mom to choose a favorite.
Yeah, right? Oh my God, I love that. So in your results section, you found that there's a smaller sample size for mantas that were exhibiting resting behavior. And I wondered, why do you think that is? Is it because you're observing them primarily during the day? Are they resting more at night? Or what's that about?
There was more of a seasonal trend to this behavior, so we observed this more during the fall and winter months. And so we didn't observe this as frequently, because when we go out on boat surveys, we always see mantas either traveling or feeding. But with resting behavior, we're actually only seeing it also in one location. So it is in one location and only during specific months. So we don't see it very often.
Wait, why?
And that location is the man-made inlet that you wrote about?
Yes, it is an inlet here in South Florida. It is actually the Boynton Beach Inlet, if anyone is local to this area. It's a very skinny inlet where boats are traveling really fast and taking this tight turn. So that's another interesting thing that to consider when we are seeing these mantas resting in this area. Because it's an area of dense boat traffics where boats are traveling high speeds, they could be running over them. And this behavior in itself is really interesting to study too, because manta rays are obligate ram ventilators, which means that they have to continuously swim to move oxygen over their gills and stay alive. And we suspect that the mantas are using this strong current for ventilation and conserve energy.
Why do you think the resting behavior is seasonal?
We're not exactly sure why. That's something that we are looking at right now. So it's something that we hope to learn more about.
Oh my gosh, I love it. I love when you start researching something and then it just sets like an entire lifetime of questions, because things keep popping up and you're like, but why? What's happening?
Your analysis produced some results that were not exactly your hypothesis. So you had three kind of primary results from your analysis. One was speed of swimming is positively correlated to wing beat frequency across all behaviors. The second is feeding and traveling behaviors had overlapping velocities and wing beat frequencies, but resting behavior was isolated in the lesser ranges of both speed and wing beat frequencies. And your last one was that traveling mantas had the fastest mean speed, followed by feeding mantas. What did you feel after finding all of these? After you proposed your hypothesis, yeah, you get through all your methods, and then you get these. How were you feeling? What were you kind of thinking?
So it was great to see that the swimming speed was positively correlated to wing beat frequency. This aligned with previous research, specifically the aquarium study that was done, where we saw there was a positive relationship across all behaviors. The thing that was most surprising to me was that there wasn't a clear of a separation between traveling and feeding behaviors, as we suspected. So in previous research, it had shown that traveling mantas were swimming much faster than feeding mantas, and we did not see that. We saw there were overlapping swimming speeds and wing beat frequencies for those two behaviors, and one of our thoughts we had was that perhaps there's a transitional behavior in between these two behaviors. We referenced a paper that talked about manta rays doing this area-restricted searching to locate areas of food. So that might be an interesting thing that we should look at further, was a possible fourth transitional behavior group that we did not note at the start of the study. There are also other possible variables that can influence their swimming that we didn't take into account, such as how much plankton is in the water, are they swimming with or against the current? So there and tides and human interaction and also boat interaction. So there are other variables that are influencing their swimming.
Yeah, I was going to ask, there's so many variables that you could try to calculate, and it almost feels like overwhelming, to be honest. I am like just so impressed at how you were able to tease out something that actually makes a lot of good sense, regardless of all these confounding variables around it.
Yeah, and we hope to, with this study, to give a good baseline for swimming kinematics so that in the future we can look at all these other variables.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask, in your paper, you also discuss some thoughts on the density of plankton and how animals were moving when they were feeding. And perhaps that is part of why you saw them like swimming faster than the traveling mantas, which is not what you had thought would happen. Can you kind of explain how prey density might impact their wing beat frequency when they're trying to feed?
Yeah, so if you theoretically, if you think about when you have a dense patch of plankton, the manta doesn't have to work as hard to feed. There is more food. It doesn't have to swim as fast. It doesn't have to swim farther away to locate more plankton. So you, with denser plankton patches, you will likely see slower swimming speeds and slower wing beat frequency. Whereas if you had a more sparse or less dense patches of plankton, the manta is likely going to have to work harder for its food. It's not located in the same area. It's going to have to look for it more. It's going to have to increase its wing beat frequency to change directions more frequently. So prey density is a likely variable that influences how mantas swim. We're actually collecting plankton samples with four feeding mantas, and for some of the feeding mantas that were included in this study, we'll be analyzing the plankton samples soon. So we'll
hopefully
we can figure out if there are more relationships between or what the relationship between prey density and swimming kinematics of feeding looks like.
That's amazing. Do you think, excuse me if you already said this, but do you think that you could look at the feeding behavior of a manta and then predict the prey density based on that?
Prey density is likely one of the variables that is affecting how a feeding manta swims. So it, if you were looking at a manta swimming in a very dense patch of plankton versus a very sparse patch of plankton, one manta is probably swimming very different than the other.
Okay, so looking at the discussion, you cited that animals optimize their hydrodynamic efficiency as seen in mantas rolling up their cephalic fins to reduce drag while swimming and conserve energy while traveling. I did not know this. I just thought it was really cool. Can you explain what are cephalic fins for people that might not know, and like why does that make them more energy efficient if they roll them up?
Yeah, so one way you can identify that a ray is a manta ray is by these large fins that come out of their heads called cephalic fins. And these are really cool features on them. They are able to either roll them up and they kind of look like horns, which is why manta rays were known as devil rays for the longest time, because people thought that they looked like they had horns on them. But when they are feeding, they actually unroll these cephalic fins and they position them so that they are touching and they're forming a funnel when they open their mouth so that they can move a lot of water through their mouth and catch plankton in their gills.
That's really cool. I actually don't think I knew that they kind of made like a funnel of water through their mouth like that.
Yeah. So mantas are filter feeders, similarly to how whales are filter feeders, and they filter their plankton through their baleen, and they have structures in their gills that act like a sieve for plankton. So when water's moving through their gills, they are obtaining oxygen, but also catching these small planktons to eat. And then once they have enough on their gills, they swallow it up.
Do mantas have teeth?
Yeah, they do have teeth. They are very small, but they do not use them for feeding. You see mantas using their teeth in courtship. So the males will actually bite onto the female's pectoral fin to position her in place. That is one of the ways you can see mantas' teeth. But they are very small and hard to see with the naked eye.
Wait, do you know if manta teeth are sexually dimorphic? We just learned this in our last episode. Do males have different shaped teeth than females?
I'm not sure. I know that the different species of manta rays have different teeth, but I'm not sure if that's different between males and females.
Got it.
But that's really interesting.
I did not know that was a thing, but apparently it is.
Me either. Then again, I know like nothing about teeth, apparently.
We're learning a lot on this podcast.
Yeah, we are. Well, I mean, that's the point of it, right? Like we wanted to learn, and here we are learning a lot of things. So you suggest that future research should evaluate plankton density next to mantas to evaluate if speed correlates with prey density. Is this something that you plan to do in the future?
Yeah, so we collected plankton samples alongside some of the feeding mantas in this study that we will analyze soon and hopefully learn more about how prey density influences swimming speed and wing beat frequency.
We'll have to have you back when that paper comes out.
Sounds good.
Sequel. So overall, what do you think these findings mean in terms of learning behavior in the scope of conservation efforts for mantas?
Yes, so we hope that our data sets a baseline for studying behavior-correlated kinematics in manta rays. And hopefully this helps us start answering more questions, like all the ones that we've discussed and the different variables that could influence their swimming and about manta rays. And using drones to study kinematics is a versatile and non-invasive method that can be applied to different animals and I think has great potential to inform conservation efforts.
Awesome. If you had to do this study again, is there anything that you would do differently?
I wish we could have collected more data for all those possible variables we discussed, but hopefully we can just answer more of those questions in the future.
Oh, yeah.
And I wish that we could have collected more data on the resting mantas, but we were restricted by how often it happens. So that's just how it goes with science sometimes.
It
is. Can't will something to happen more often.
Yeah, I actually have been learning that myself recently. One of my advisors has been like, no, you could keep collecting data forever. Like at some point you just have to stop and wrap up what you currently found. And then the next question that you have that expands on it is your next paper. Like you have to stop at some point, which for me is actually kind of hard.
Definitely. Because we are still collecting videos now and we just had to be like, okay, it's the end of our field season. Let's just analyze all these videos. We'll write about it. We'll wrap it up and then restart when we want to. But yeah, you can collect data forever if you have the funding to do so.
Yeah, no kidding.
Absolutely.
Okay, well now it's our favorite part of the podcast where we ask for a field story. So this can be inspiring or funny or just otherwise anecdotal. What do you have for us?
Yeah, so one of my favorite memories while being on the boat with the Florida Manta Project was with the first time we saw manta number 123. So the first time that we saw this manta was November of last year. And the first thing that we're trying to get with the mantas are an ID shot. So this is where a snorkeler enters the water with a GoPro. We try to get a good shot of their bellies. And how easy or hard it is really depends on the personality of the manta. Some mantas are super friendly. They'll slow down. They'll just sit there and wait for you to swim by. Some mantas are very avoidant. They don't want anything to do with you. They'll swim really fast. And this was a more avoidant manta. And it was really hard initially to get the ID shot because it kept swimming away. But on the second or third try, I was able to get close to the manta and get the ID shot. But I also noticed that there was a fishing lure hooked into its shoulder with about 3 feet of trailing fishing line. So I got back in the water with shears and I cut off as much of the line as possible. And the manta actually calmed right down and it knew what we were doing and it was very tolerant of us trying to get the gear off. I will have to say, I have to put a disclaimer, this was done for scientific research. Please don't do this on your own and go out just cutting gear off of manta rays. We're doing all of this with supervision. And the hook was very thick and deep into the flesh, and we had multiple trained volunteers in getting in to try and get the hook out. We tried with shears, we tried with wire cutters, we couldn't get it out. And we didn't have success at the end of that day. And we were really bummed that we couldn't get that fishing gear out. But then we saw the manta again a week later, and the fishing lure and the hook had fallen out.
Oh my gosh.
So it was a really great surprise. And hopefully I was just really bummed that we couldn't help that manta out more. But we saw it again a week later, and hopefully the wiggling that we did or something had helped it fall out. So that was just a big relief, yeah. And that was a pleasant surprise.
Oh, that's awesome.
I love happy endings.
Me too. And I'm so glad that you actually saw the manta a week later, because what if you had just like not seen it again?
Yeah, we actually see a lot of our mantas again. About like 40% of our individuals are resighted. So we get to really know the mantas and over a season, which is really fun.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on Sharkpedia. We were so excited to, one, find your paper and also have you come on. So thank you so much. Where can our Sharkies follow you and your work?
Yeah, so on Instagram, my personal account is at vicky.fong, so that's vicky.fong. But you can also follow the Florida Manta Project's work on Jessica Pate's account, Florida Manta Girl, or at Marine Megafauna for all of Marine Megafauna Foundation's work.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Vicky. Sharkies, everyone, make sure you go follow her. And until next time,
swim you later.
I forgot that word. Feeding mantas swim slower than traveling mantas to optimize filter feeding and dank.
Did you just snort?
Oh my god, I'm so sorry. I'm gonna say that again.